Chapter 14. Cambions. The Vesalius ran silent through a corroded spur of the webway. Fabius watched through a static-ridden pict feed as the frigate passed through broken, bone-white reefs of alien matter and toxic clouds of demonic substance. A moment later, its warning bells tolled out into the blackened spiral depths, scattering flocks and shoals of Neverborn before it. Occasionally, the edges of the Vesalius's Geller field would strike one of these shoals of impossible, squirming shapes, and the demons would evaporate in their hundreds, much to the amusement of their wiser, swifter fellows. Defensive turrets silently tracked distant shapes, as large as any warship, as they clambered through the crooked celestial architecture of subspace. There were giants in the webway, but they seemed content to keep to themselves, at least for the moment. The frigate powered towards the distant, shimmering square of the webway portal without incident, for which Fabius, in his laboratorium, was glad. He stood in the tertiary stratagerium, located in an antechamber of the apothecarium, and observed the vessel's progress with satisfaction. The functions of the command deck had been surreptitiously slaved to the stratagerium centuries ago, enabling him to communicate with Wulver and the crew directly without having to abide Alkanex or one of his servants looking over his shoulder. The ship was his, whatever Alkanex thought, and it would remain so.
"Rotate forward sensor array 2 points," he said, tapping one of the holo displays that swarmed about him like flies. "Wide sweep."
The monotone voice of a servitor assented, and a sensor feed flickered to life, joining the rest of the swarm. Despite his assurances to the inimitable prefect, travelling through these compromised sections of subspace was not without substantial risk.
"Here there be monsters," he muttered,
as the Vesalius's aft sensor array detected something massive burrowing through the tunnels nearby. The webway shook, and clouds of dislodged debris crunched against the ship's hull with a sound like distant thunder. Fabius silenced the proximity alarms before they could reach the command deck and alert Alkanex's proxies that anything was amiss. As the unseen Leviathan receded deeper into subspace, Fabius made a note of the time and place on the rough, cartographic hollow overlay that curved around the interior of the stratagerium. He fancied he was one of the few individuals outside of the Eldar to possess a working knowledge of the webway. And with every trip through its vastitude, he only added to that knowledge. Come the day, the subdimension might prove to be a secure bolt hole. He had already noted any number of isolated spurs that would provide the necessary space for an apothecarium in the event of Urum's destruction.
"What are they doing?" Fulgrim asked, interrupting his calculations.
The clone crouched atop a nearby examination slab, his attentions on the small knot of Vatborn in the corner of the laboratorium. It was not the first, or even the 50th question he'd asked in the hours since he'd destroyed the last of the training servitors. His skill at combat seemed as instinctive as his knowledge base, and returned more swiftly. Even as a youth of 16 cycles now, he was impossibly lethal.
"Assembling rebreathers," Fabius said,
watching the pale youth observe the Vatborn. He shuddered slightly, remembering the damage those thin limbs had done to the heavily armoured servitors. Metal had buckled beneath swift blows, and cybernetically upgraded combat systems had proven no match for raw ferocity. It was no wonder that most of the Primarchs had ascended to control their own planets in a scant few decades.
"They make their own, though they have not needed them in several centuries. I suspect it has some cultural or religious significance."
"But you made them."
"And," Fabius chuckled, "it is the nature of sentient species to invent stories to explain, well, everything."
Though some took it to extraordinary lengths, admittedly. The Harlequins were one such example. They lived and died by the story they were trying to tell. Thoughts of the Xenos made him glance at the sensor feed scrolling across the hololithic screens floating about him. Periodic sweeps of the Vesalius had showed any number of oddities, but nothing Xenos-related, as far as he could tell. That did not mean they were not there, however. That did not mean that they were not watching, even now. The chirurgeon chirped a warning as his heart rates increased. He forced himself to remain calm. It was not fear that he felt, so much as anticipation. And anticipation of an event that might never come was a distraction. "Am I a story?" Fulgrim asked. Fabius hesitated. Fulgrim was looking at him, violet eyes wide and full of innocent curiosity. How did one answer a question like that? He cleared his throat.
"Of a sort. Your name, for instance, is derived from a Kermosian folktale."
Fulgrim smiled.
"I would like to be a story, I think. I would be a good one."
There was an earnestness there that was almost painfully at odds with the Fulgrim he knew. Then, perhaps not. Fulgrim had been flamboyant, true, but never anything less than serious when it came to his drive for perfection.
"Yes," Fabius said softly. "Yes, you could be at that."
Thoughts swelled and crashed in Fabius's mind like the waters of a storm-tossed sea. Almost 2 centuries before, in the forest of crystal seers on the craft world Luganath, he had been given a glimpse of his possible futures and fates. In one of those, he had led a resurgent third out of the eye. He had dismissed it initially, no more than a shadow on a cave wall. But events seemed to be conspiring that way. If the gene seed were real and not some mad fancy of Eidolon's, it might be enough to rebuild the Legion. But could he do it? Should he? It was all too perfect, too neat. A story moving along familiar lines. He'd heard similar stories as a child. A lost king, a slumbering army, a new golden age.
"Am I the Myrdin of myth now, aging backwards and growing swords from stones?"
He looked at Fulgrim. Was the clone his Cambion? A changeling and child of demons, or something more glorious? The youthful clone sat hunkered before the Vatborn, chirping eerily. Fabius started in surprise as he realized that at some point in the past few moments, Fulgrim had apparently deciphered the mutant's language. He was learning at an impressive rate, and he displayed no signs of warp corruption or genetic degeneration. He was perfect.
"We could start over," Fabius said to himself. "A new legion, a new Primarch, the third reborn, cleansed of the sins that had claimed it. A third that he could guide along his own path. With them, he might be able to..." No, that way lay distraction. The legions and their gene fathers had had their chance, and they'd failed. Humanity must stand on its own if it was to prosper in the world to come. But as he watched the youthful copy of his gene father ingratiate himself to the Vatborn, Fabius could not help but feel a twinge of doubt. Alkanex looked around the Wraithbone-shrouded bay in barely concealed disgust.
"And what is the purpose of this place?" he murmured. "Is it a garden?"
"Yes," Merrick said.
Everything hummed with a strange sort of energy, as if the spreading tendrils of Wraithbone were harmonizing with the immense structures they were even now passing through. Merrick shied away from the thought. Though he was careful not to show it, the webway disturbed him. He had seen demon worlds that were less disturbing on the whole than the silent immensity of the subspatial labyrinth. Overhead, simian shapes ran shrieking through the tangled branches. The slaves of the cacophony alerted their masters to the intruders with shrill cries that resonated oddly through the new-grown contours of the garden. Alkanex glared at the pale, ape-like shapes, his hand on the hilt of his sword.
"Must they make such a racket?"
"Yes, hands away from your sword, now."
Merrick lifted his hands to show that he was weaponless to whoever might be watching.
"Hail, Ramos, Bull of the Eighth! We greet you, brother," he called out.
"Merrick's,"
the noise marine growled, stepping beneath a swooping arch of Wraithbone. The substance quivered in time to his voice. Merrick's had heard him coming the moment they'd entered the garden.
"Why do you interrupt my labors, brother?"
"I wish you to meet someone," Merrick said, indicating Alkanex. "Prefect Flavius Alkanex, equerry to the Lord Commander Primus."
The hulking noise marine laughed, a growling, guttural sound that made the connector nodes of Merrick's prosthetics tighten painfully.
"Eidolon, I thought we had drawn near harmony. The ghost sounds of its death danced among the branches of our grove for some time."
Ramos studied Alkanex with a single bloodshot eye.
"And what do you want, equerry to the Lord Commander Primus?"
"Merely to speak with you, Bull of the Eighth. They sing your praises among the choirs of the Cacophony. You cracked the lunar gate with a single scream and speared the heart of the Titan Albia's hand with your song." He looked around. "The chief apothecary does not treat you with the respect you deserve, brother." Ramos grunted, and the sound thrummed through the air. Wraithbone crunched as more noise marines appeared, slipping through the artificial forest like shadows. Merrick's could feel the subsonic pulses of their communication on the air. There were barely more than 20 of them left since Lugarnath, a small choir by some estimations, but Merrick's knew that these 20 could split the Vesalius open from the inside out with but a single note. And whether he knew it or not, Alkanex needed them. Ramos and his brothers were the key to the Wraithbone network that permeated the ship. They had sung it into being, and only by their song did it flourish. Without them, it would wither and die, and perhaps take the Vesalius and all those aboard with it. But that mastery had not come without cost. Knots and walls of Wraithbone grew through and across their altered forms. They had spent so long in the garden that many of them were becoming one with it, in some impossible manner. Even Ramos was encrusted with barnacles of the stuff. The noise marine laughed again.
And what would you know of respect, Hound of Eidolon? We are but weapons to you and your master."
"You are Legion, and the Legion is a weapon."
"We have not been Legion for a long time, Prefect. We are something more now, and our concerns are greater than bloodshed. War is a child's song. We sing of greater things, and are sung too, and with every note the song grows ever more perfect. What can you offer us equal to that?"
Alkanex seemed at a loss for words. Merrick's interposed himself.
"We could free you from this cage, or at least increase its size. How perfect might your song become if we were to give you a ship to yourself rather than one isolated bay? Or even a world. Imagine how glorious your garden might grow then."
"And how do you know that he has not offered us one?"
Ramos took a step towards them, gauntlets flexing. Merrick's tensed as a sonic pressure clutched at him. He felt Alkanex stiffen and hoped the prefect would be wiser than to go for his sword. Ramos and his choir could kill them with insultingly little effort.
"Has he?"
Merrick's asked.
"We know what you want, prefect,"
Ramos continued, as if he hadn't spoken.
"We have heard the whispers of your plotting through the Wraithbone. You want the ship, but we are the ship, and we do not care who struts upon the command deck issuing useless orders. The Vesalius goes where it wills, and our song continues uninterrupted. The chief apothecary knows this, and so he does not waste time assuring himself of our loyalty. We are loyal only to the song, only to the singer. We..."
He hesitated, falling silent. As one, the noise marines turned, their heads cocked like those of attentive hounds. They stared silently towards the heart of the garden, as if listening to some voice that only they could hear. Then, in unison, they stepped aside. Ramos gestured.
The singer would see you.
The thick branches of Wraithbone rustled and twisted aside, moving like a living thing, revealing a narrow path through the pallid forest. Silently, Merix led Alkanex into the still heart of the garden. The singer was waiting for them, sitting cross-legged amid billowing folds of Wraithbone. It did not look at them as they drew close, for which Merix was glad. Tendrils of Wraithbone had inserted themselves into the creature's bare flesh, and they ran along its arms and legs like thin roots, connecting it to the wider garden. It was the living brain of the garden, the singer of the song.
What is it?
Alkanex hissed, one hand on his sword.
He calls it Key.
Merix eyed the seated figure warily.
A prisoner once. Now it is a tool. Though I am not certain just what its function is. It's one of the reasons why I thought you should see this place. It might prove of some use.
Better, I think, to kill it,
Alkanex said. He made to draw his sword, but froze as a soft, sibilant laughter gusted through the Wraithbone thicket around them. The two renegades turned, seeking the source of the sound. Shadows danced and capered amid the branches, indistinct and unnatural. They were being watched.
What are they? Neverborn?
Merrick shook his head.
I don't know.
But he did. Beautiful faces twisted into expressions of serene malice watched him through the branches. Their black eyes, as deep and as empty as the void, met his own, and he looked away. The ache pounded at his thoughts, his hand twitched of its own volition. Alkanex took a step towards Key. The Eldar turned its blind eyes towards him, but made no move to rise or defend itself. The shadows fell silent, save for a soft whispering. The Wraithbone seemed to flex in anticipation. Watching it, and the creature that controlled it, Merrick suddenly realized that he'd made a mistake bringing Alkanex here. This place was not his secret to share, and there were some places on this ship that would never belong to them, however they might scheme. Neverborn crowded about him, whispering, laughing, their phantasmal talons digging into his wounds, prodding him to speak.
We should go,
he said. Key tilted its head, and he caught Alkanex's arm.
Now.
Alkanex glanced at him, as if to chastise him, but he simply nodded.
Yes, we will return later and burn this filth. We will purge the ship of it and all Xenos influence, save that which we keep for our own entertainment.
Key smiled at this, the first expression Merrix had ever seen on its face. He kept hold of Alkanex and gestured for him to be silent. Eyeless the thing was, but it could clearly still hear. Key opened its mouth, and something like the trill of a bird emerged. The sound reverberated on the air, and the Wraithbone began to sway and undulate. The two legionaries slowly retreated back the way they had come, passing warily through the swaying garden and the eerily silent ranks of noise marines, past the squalling ape-things and out into the dubious safety of the corridors beyond. Alkanex stared at the hatchway as it cycled closed and said, "We might have to destroy this ship afterwards, when things are settled." Merrick nodded, trying not to look at the thousands of roots of Wraithbone that extended beneath the skin of the internal hull all around them.
"That might be for the best."
In the training bay, Igori moved, enjoying the dull ache in her muscles. She leapt over the combat servitor, boosting herself over its hunched frame and landing behind it in a crouch. Even as her boots touched the deck, her knife was in her hand, and she was launching herself at the nest of power cables that bunched beneath the plates of the servitor's armor. The machine slave reacted more quickly than she'd hoped, spinning its top half around to meet her. Chain blades and electro-lashes darted to intercept her, and she was forced to drop. Instinctively, she scrambled beneath its jointed, insect-like legs. Her knife slashed out, chopping through the power supply to its gyroscopic motivator. The servitor juddered as it registered the damage. It could no longer rotate its upper body, and it began the laborious process of turning itself about to pursue her. As it made to turn, she leapt for its chassis. She speedily clambered up its heaving shape, slicing through cables and pneumatic pumps as she moved. She rolled aside, barely holding onto it, as a chain blade slashed through the space where her head had been. She caught the piston-like limb attached to the blade and drove her boot into the joint, momentarily dislodging it. The chain blade stuttered, frozen in position. Out of the corner of her eye, she caught sight of someone entering the chamber. She smiled. Deftly, she cut through hoses and cables, further disabling the machine. Its arms waved helplessly as she caught hold of the nest of cortical conduits and jerked its head back. The red eyes glared up at her dumbly. If the machine slave could feel fear, she couldn't tell. She hoped so. It was no good killing something that couldn't comprehend its own mortality. Spinning the knife about, she chopped down at the reinforced spinal strut, severing it with two blows. Sparks spewed upwards, stinging her lips and cheeks. Bracing herself, she tore the head free of the chassis and flung it aside. Oil stained her arms and hands as the machine slave shuddered in its death throes. Panting slightly, she allowed herself a small smile. It was good to know that she was still strong. Even better that there had been an audience to that display of strength. She dropped to the deck.
"You may speak now, if you wish."
"You are skilled,"
Savona said as she stepped forward. She smelled of strange places and unnatural acts, like many of the Emperor's children. But she was not one of them, no matter how much she aped them. She was something else. Igori had not yet decided whether that meant she wasn't prey, like them, or just a different sort of quarry.
"Why are you here?" "It is rare that we get to speak," Savona drawled, setting her hoof on the servitor's sparking skull. "Rarer still that one of us wishes to do so."
Igori eyed her warily.
"What do you want? A respectful tone would be nice."
Igori flipped her knife up and sheathed it.
"That I have not killed you is respect enough, I think. Talk."
Savona smiled.
"Tried to kill me, you mean? Tried?"
Igori shrugged and crossed her arms.
"Talk."
Savona stepped back and kicked the servitor's head across the deck.
"I heard that your dog sent one of Alkanex's spies running with teeth marks in his ceramite. Is this true?"
Igori frowned.
"Yes. He should not have disturbed us." "They will be back, and in force. If not immediately, then later. When the man-flayer cannot protect you."
Savona swung her maul down and planted the head against the deck. She leaned forward on the haft.
"They do not like you very much. Predators do not concern themselves with the opinions of prey."
A flicker of movement above caught her eye. The twins. They had been watching from the high places as they always did. Watching Igori, waiting for her to show some sign of weakness so that they might challenge her and take command of the pack as they had been born to do. Savona laughed.
"Oh, very good. Did he teach you that?" "The benefactor has taught us much, but there are some things we have learned for ourselves."
Igori rested her palm on the hilt of her knife.
"Like not to trust those altered by the warp."
She signalled Mesha and Meshana with a glance, and they rose, ready to act. Savona nodded.
"A good lesson. But you do not have to trust me to listen to what I have to say. You have enemies. Your benefactor has enemies. They are on this ship, and they will seek to do him and you harm. But you also have allies."
She touched her chestplate.
"Myself, for instance."
Igori kept her features neutral.
"Why?" "Because those who move against you will also move against me in time. I am not Legion, and they will seek to purge me from my position. But they will come for you first. Already Arkanek seeks to subvert your benefactor in the eyes of some. He has even visited Diomat in his silent cage, though the Dreadnought ignored him, as he ignores everyone who is not the chief apothecary. And so, what is this to me? I am trying to warn you, to propose an alliance against a common foe.
Savona gestured, as if bemused.
Surely, even you understand that.
Why come to me? Igori pressed.
We are two of a kind, Savona said.
Igori shrugged.
We are nothing alike, Savona smirked. But we are on the same side.
Igori stretched.
No, we are not.
Visibly annoyed now, Savona leaned forward.
I need to speak to him.
Ah, there it was. Savona needed her, not as an ally, but as a go-between. So, go.
Your kin guard the way. No one gets through without permission.
Igori smiled. Do you have permission?
No.
Then you cannot speak to him. Savona bared her fangs.
I could fight my way through if I wished. Is that what you want?
She lifted her maul, her thumb caressing the switch that would activate the power field.
Are you so arrogant that you can casually dismiss me?
Igori's smile faded.
You are all alike. Prey that thinks itself a predator. Soft things wrapped in hard shells. We eat you the way you eat mutants.
She bared her strong, even teeth.
And yet you never understand until it is too late. You think we are weak because we are not so strong as you. But the bovid is stronger than the lupines that hunt it. Is the lupine weak, then? Compared to me, yes.
Savona pointed her maul at Igori.
If you think you are strong enough to deny me, come ahead.
Igori whistled. Savona spun as she registered the soft scrape of feet on the deck. The twins lunged for her, one high, one low. Meisha let his sister lead the dance, as was his way. Meishane swept her blade down, forcing Savona to block it before vaulting away from the riposte. Meisha seized the opening when it was offered, and his blade came closer still, scraping paint from Savona's chest plate. She snarled and kicked out at him, nearly taking his head off with a hoof. Igori watched the duel carefully, analyzing Savona's movements for weakness. All prey had a weak point. Some were arrogant, others were stupid, a few were cunning. Most were a mix of all three. They thought their armor and strength made them invincible, but the Glandhounds had learned how to turn invincibility on its head. Isolate and overwhelm, bait and trap, simple tricks for simple hunters. Savona was quicker than most, more observant, but that would not save her. The twins' knives scratched and scored her stolen battle plate again and again, never deeply and never for long, but enough to make the point. The power maul crackled as it punched through the air. One touch, and their flesh would blacken and crumble from the bone. So the twins made sure to avoid its touch. They leapt and rolled, moving like acrobats. It was the Eldar in them, Igori thought. That extra twist in their genetic makeup, giving them greater agility than their predecessors possessed. The twins were faster than she had ever imagined being, and she could not help but feel a twinge of envy at their grace. With every generation, the Glandhounds drew further from the template. They were refined and perfected by the hands of the benefactor, century by century. And soon they would be complete. Soon he would step back from them and set down his knives so that they might take up their own. Igori did not think she would live to see that day, whatever the benefactor said. It seemed too far off, unreal and inconceivable. She pushed the thought aside. She was old, but she had a few centuries yet. Savona's power maul slammed down, crumpling a deck plate. Meisha vaulted away, laughing. Savona started after him, her hand falling to the bolt pistol on her hip. Igori drew her knife and sprang. Her long arms wrapped around Savona's neck, even as her legs scissored about her middle, pinning the renegade's arms. She pressed the edge of her knife to the underside of Savona's throat.
"You're dead," she whispered. "As simple as that."
Savona froze.
"He made us to hunt your kind."
She spoke softly into Savona's ear.
"To pry you open and fetch him the prize within. That was our purpose, and now it is our joy."
She nuzzled the woman's cheek, inhaling her scent, enjoying the smell of her growing agitation.
"It is the dearest ritual of our people, the cracking of ceramite and the cutting of the black carapace. You are our sacrificial animals, and we offer you up to him."
Igori pressed the knife slightly, drawing a thin trickle of ichor from her captive's flesh.
"You are stronger than us, but we are many, and our numbers swell. Soon we will hunt the last of you, and that will be a day filled with sadness and rejoicing, for we will have fulfilled one purpose and become free to find a new one. If you wish to see that day, you will deactivate your weapon and drop it."
Savona hesitated, then did as she was bidden. The weapon fell with a thump.
"Now what?"
she asked.
"Now we take you to the benefactor. You wished to see him, yes?"
"Yes."
Igori slid off her. She wiped a line of ichor off the blade and licked it from her finger. She smiled as Savona retrieved her maul.
"Next time, you will ask more politely, I think."